Open your Bibles with me to Solomon's Song, or the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon is an interesting little book, not a very long book, but if God has given eyes to see and ears to hear, it's an incredibly profound book. It is the view of the average commentator that Song of Solomon is nearly beyond our ability to understand. Many of the commentaries rank Song of Solomon up with the Book of Revelation in its difficulty of trying to understand it. I believe this is because there is a basic fundamental contextual missing component. What I mean by that is that there's a context that they're missing, and that's why they misunderstand it. The context of the Word of God, the context of the Song of Solomon, is that there is a special place in the mind of God for His people. And especially when we come into the New Testament, the people of God have a special place in the mind of God. And then, I'm saying that in the sense of the family of God, all those that are born again, are born into the family of God. Even that phrase, born again, is a family term. I was born to Don and Jean Graver. I was born into that family. And we are, as a child of God, we are born into the family of God. What folks miss prevailing today, in a very predominant way today, they'll say that you're born into the church. And see, the Bible doesn't teach that. And that's what they miss, and that's how they miss the profoundness of the Song of Solomon. When you understand that the Bible teaches you are born again, born into the family of God, and you, by the leadership of the Spirit of God, are added unto His kind of a church, and that that church is one in kind, and in the New Testament, then many in number, and that church is always, the New Testament church, is always a localized and visible body. It's a group of believers gathering together like we are here tonight. This is a localized and very literal and visible body of people. However big, however small, if it's one of the Lord's churches, it is a localized, visible body of His people. And those who are members of this church have been added onto the membership of this church by scriptural baptism. They're born into the family. They were baptized into the church. Once that is understood, there's a lot in the New Testament that comes into new focus. You begin to read the church epistles as letters written to specific churches, and therefore you take its context and you apply it to churches instead of just generally applying it overall. You take the ordinance of the Lord's Supper and it's applied in the local church. And that way we understand that the Lord's Supper is a church function. When that becomes plainer, more plain. Plainer's probably not a good word. Plainer's a thing you shave wood off with, isn't it, Brother Elmer? Once this becomes plain in our eyes, and we begin to see that, the context of the New Testament begins to come into sharper focus. And once that happens, Song of Solomon bursts into our understanding with incredibly profound vibrance. And it makes it such that it's not nearly so hard to understand because you put it in its context and it makes much more sense. Solomon wrote this, that's obvious. And it very possibly would have flowed out of a personal experience that Solomon had. But even more profound than the love story that is described by the pen of Solomon and by the mind of Solomon is the love story that is Christ and his church. In a very specific way, Christ and his church. He's related to all believers by faith, but he is espoused right now to his church. Hold your finger in Song of Solomon. Go up with me to Ephesians 5. We'll get you this context. Ephesians 5. We want to start notice in verse 24. Notice here he's speaking of the church in verse 24. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. So in both verses, while he is using the husband and wife relationship as an illustration, his context is of the church. And he goes on and talks about that in verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle, or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. Notice he keeps coming back to that, and there's a reason. For we are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Not all of the saved of all of the ages, not even all of the saved of this age, but Christ and his church. Now, so we have in that text, what you can easily see is the groom, which is Christ, the bride, which is the church, and from other corresponding texts, you can easily see then the family. And right there in Ephesians, I should have, you can back up to 3:15, and right there in Ephesians. Of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. Now, I jumped into the middle of a thought, but notice how the family is described. The whole family in heaven and earth. So in the book of Ephesians, you can see the bride, the groom, and the family. Okay? Guess who the three main players or characters in the Song of Solomon might be? There's a bride, there's a groom, and there's, the Song of Solomon uses the phrase, daughters of Jerusalem, 7 times. Daughters of Jerusalem will represent, if you study the book of Song of Solomon, the daughters of Jerusalem will represent those that are saved, but not the bride. Those that are saved. And even when you look in the book of Revelation and you notice that the bride dwells in the New Jerusalem and then all the elect can come in and go out. They don't dwell in, but they're allowed to come in. There's a special relationship between the groom and his bride. I have a special relationship with my bride. I know you folks, but I have a special relationship with her. Her doctor may know more about her physically, what problems she may be dealing with. Her doctor may know more about her in some respects, but I know her better. I know what makes her smile. I know what doesn't. There's a special relationship between the bride and the groom. That's not to say that there aren't any other relationships, but it's a special one. In the Song of Solomon, there's a fella that has drawn a woman unto himself. That's Christ, drawing his love unto himself, his church. And then look at in Song of Solomon, chapter 5 and verse 16, you can actually see all of the three main players in this play, if you will. 5:16. She says this: "His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved." So in that part of the phrase right there, in that part of the sentence right there, Song of Solomon 5:16, she says, "His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend. O daughters of Jerusalem." Notice that in that verse, you can see the female. You can see the bride describing her groom. You can see her express her love for him. She calls him my beloved. So you can see her, you can see him, and then you can see the daughters of Jerusalem, a phrase that's used seven times. You can see that's the three main players of the book. That's the three key ones that you'll keep an eye on when you begin to watch, when you begin to study and read this book. There are three main scenes in this drama. In the first couple of chapters, now it doesn't break evenly, so I'll just say in the first few chapters, the king courts his bride. He wins her heart. Now we're talking about Christ winning the heart of his people. So we recognize it in the sense of a man winning the heart of a woman. We understand that. We recognize that. And that is what Solomon is, in the literal sense, writing out. But in a deeper sense, he's giving us a type and a picture and a foreshadowing of Christ winning the heart of his bride. And so the first scene is the king courts his bride. The second scene is the king claims his bride. He's won her heart and she has dedicated herself to him and they've married. And he claims his bride. And in the third scene, the last couple of chapters of the book, the king communes with his wife, not his bride. But I mean, not his espoused bride any longer, but now his wife. And so that drama will unfold. I tried my best to pick a cross section of Song of Solomon to stand back and give you the cliff notes of what's going on in these eight chapters. Start with me in chapter 1 in Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. Verse 1 is simply the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, identifies the author. "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is ointment poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. Draw me," notice this, "draw me, we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee. Already you can see the prophetical aspects, the typology aspects that are in there, where the Lord is drawing his own. And she even uses that phrase, draw me. We run after thee. But then in verses 5 and 6, she recognizes who she is. Now when it says here in verse 5, I am black, it is not talking about skin color. It's talking about the fact that she is spotted and not clean. Now notice, I am black, but comely. O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon, look not upon me because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard have I not kept. What she's saying is, in my understanding of this, is that I have not been pampered and shielded and protected. I am not king bride material. I have been made to work in the field. My skin shows it. I am dirty. I am sweaty. I have had to labor in the field. My hands are calloused and rough, and I am spotted and wrinkled, and I am not king's bride material. But that didn't matter. He loved her anyway, and he begins to draw her. But she recognizes her unworthiness. As God begins to draw us, that's one of the first things we recognize, is our unworthiness. And then as he begins to draw and save and work upon our hearts, the love that reciprocates is unbelievable. And that's what happens here. Verse 7. Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth. This is in the voice of the woman. Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon. For why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions? Now the response from the man. If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tents. You'll know where I am by where my flock is. You'll be able to find me when you find my flock, because I'm there with my flock. And she says, show me where you are. Show me how to get to you. Because she's been drawn by his love. And he says, find my flock, you'll find me. A lot of pictures in that. We don't have time to go into all that. Find the flock and you'll find me. Verses 9 and 10. This makes me smile every time I read it. This is in the voice of the man. I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariots. You ladies like that? You want to be called a horse? Oh, Jenny, you're my favorite horse. You know, look what he says. I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariots. Thy cheeks are comely, thy with rows of jewels, thy neck with chains of gold. But think about the horses in Pharaoh's army. The best of the best. The most trained of any. Bought with a price. Think about the horses in Pharaoh's army. He's not going to have some bucking mule. He's not going to have some little runt of a horse. He's going to have the best. He's going to have the fastest. He's going to have them well fed, well doctored, well trained. And he bought and paid for every one of them. They're his. And he protects them. He cares for them. The horse is the lifeblood of the man in the chariot. And so this is an important animal and well cared for and well loved. And the man says to her, I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses. One of the most profound statements, if you really stop to tear it apart and think about it. Well, in chapter 2, she begins to respond even more. And she says in verse 8, the voice of my beloved. Exclamation point. Notice that. The voice of my beloved. 2:8. Behold, he cometh leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a roe or a young hart, an antelope or deer. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh forth at the windows, showing himself through the lattice. My beloved spake and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. So she begins to respond. She loves him with a deep reciprocal love. Her heart pounds the faster when he speaks. Verse 16, my beloved is mine, and I am his. My beloved is mine. The confidence that is there now in her heart for him. Chapter 3 and verse 6. I believe this is a verse that has 1,000 pictures rolled into it. Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? What I believe is being described here is the victorious king thundering out of the wilderness back home. He has conquered. He has gone. He has faced the armies. He has conquered. He has the spoils of the war to prove it. He's coming back to prove that he survived it. And then he's conquered. And he's thundering back like the pillars out of the wilderness, like the pillars of smoke. From the distance, you can see him coming and his entourage. From the distance, you can hear the thunder of them coming back out of the wilderness. And it tells you he's victorious. He has been victorious as he has rescued her, you see. Now, if you read on down through the end of the chapter, I believe you'll see that theme explained more fully. But for time's sake, we'll go to chapter 4. Now again, Christ begins to describe his love for her. Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Now there's another picture that you'd have to kind of be there to get the full grasp of. My understanding is that from picture this. You're standing off in a distance, and off in the distance you can see Mount Gilead. And from the distance you can see her or it rolling, the rolling hills from the top to the bottom. And now cover those rolling hills with, what does it say? Goats, flock of goats. Cover those rolling hills with all that goat hair rolling down majestically. you stand off in the distance and watch a hill that has all the leaves turning colors, and you stand back and you just say, wow, that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Take that away and cover it with goat's hair, cover it with this hair. And from a distance, all you see is that flowing down, locks and curls, long flowing hair. One of the crown jewels of the lady's beauty, long flowing hair. And he says, thou art fair. And he goes on in very, very descriptive terms to describe his bride and his love for every aspect of his bride. In chapter 5, the sad reality is, while the beloved is perfect in every way, our bride in this drama is not. And in chapter 5, she's asleep. And he's not able to rouse her like he ought. He comes to the door and she hears him, but she's not quite aroused enough. And I don't mean aroused in a sensual way, but he comes to the door, she's asleep. She hears him, but I don't really want to get up. Kind of like Jordan every morning. I don't really want to get up. I hear you, but I got a few minutes yet. And that's basically what she said to him. And then when she finally did get up, he left. Verse 5:4. My beloved put his hand by the hole of the door. My bowels removed for him, finally. I rose up to open to my beloved. My hands dropped with myrrh, my fingers with sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. She wasn't demonstrating proper love for him, and he withdrew himself for a period of time. Picture of Christ in his church. That's very explicit. Now she has a newfound desire and zeal. And in this chapter, chapter 5, verse 9, she's looking for him, and the in verse 8, she's looking for him. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I'm sick of love. Now, her heart was breaking with love, not sick, as one might think. And in verse 9, they ask her a probing question. Now, in this question, you understand, what is thy beloved more than another beloved? Indicates a few things. Number one, the daughters of Jerusalem didn't know him like she did. And number two, she had a bad testimony briefly because she didn't demonstrate her preeminent love for him. And they look at her and say, he doesn't act any you don't seem to act any different about him than anybody else. What makes him special? Sometimes the world could look at us and say, you don't look any different than us. What makes your God special? You see? Well, to hurry on, they asked her this probing question, and it begins to make her think. And in verse 10, she starts describing him. My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. You see, now that he had withdrawn himself, got her attention, now that the daughters of Jerusalem had asked her this probing question, got her to thinking, as she goes on and describes him, she ends with verse 16, his mouth is most sweet, yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now she has a newfound passion for him. The vibrance has been restored. Problem is, he had withdrawn himself because of her coolness and disobedience. But in this, we learn a lesson of something I brought out over and over and over. How do you love the Lord more? How do you grow your love for God? You learn more about Him. You learn more about who He is, how He operates, how He saved you, what kind of a miracle salvation is, and you'll fall in love with Him more and more and more. As she pondered on who He is and described Him to the daughters of Jerusalem, she just finally just explains, I can't describe anymore. He is altogether lovely. There's no spot in Him. I can go on and describe from now to infinity, and I can't completely describe Him, so I just say this. He's altogether lovely. Chapter 6, verse 9, tells us something about His love for her. Well, verse 4, they've reunited, thou art beautiful, O my love. Verse 9, my dove, my undefiled, is but one. 6:9, my undefiled is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and blessed her. Yea, the queens and the concubines, they praised her. We see now in this text, and if you remember, I preached from this text the year that the car flipped over out here in the yard at the conference. And fortunately for me, I was scheduled to preach prior to that happening and everything kind of going crazy afterwards, but I preach from that text. My beloved is, or the bride is but one. In the eyes of Christ, there's a very preeminent place, as it should be, for His bride. She is but one. The bride of Christ is not going to be some kind of Frankenstein bride made up of all denominations and all religious beliefs and all kinds of doctrinal systems. The bride of Christ is but one. And it's incumbent upon us to find out that one. And that'll be found in the New Testament, and that will be found as we truly take the Bible and make it our final rule of faith and practice. And that's one of those distinctives that I believe sets Faith Missionary Baptist Church apart. But that shows you the preeminent place of the bride in the eyes of the groom. In chapter 7 and verse 10, I am my beloved's, and His desire is toward me. She now is confident in His love. She knows that what He is doing for her is for her best interest. In chapter 8 and verse 5, who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? There's something about this verse that I believe will help unlock what's going on if we get one thing in our understanding. What I believe is happening is not a question in the sense that they're looking for an answer. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness? I believe what this is the groom making a statement about his bride. I believe this is the groom calling attention to her. As a bride walks into the back of the auditorium and folks rise up to notice her. That's what's going on in this verse, I believe. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness? Remember, the victorious king coming out of the wilderness, back a few chapters. And now the picture is leaning upon her beloved. She's safe and secure in him. And it's as if he is saying, he's presenting her and saying, look, there she is. Remember Ephesians 5? He's going to present her to himself without spot, without wrinkle. And she enters the room, figuratively speaking, and all stand and say, wow, beauty. It's a love story. The conquering king gets the lady. He woos her, he draws her, he rescues her. She's not always perfect, but he's working that in her. And at the end, you can see the victorious nature of their relationship overcomes anything. She is leaning on him as they ride from the wilderness. Now she loves him beyond measure and for eternity. And that, in a nutshell, is the love story that is Song of Solomon. It's an amazing book. Let's pray.